you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest today is activist, author, and scholar Rinku Sen, the former president and director of the racial justice organization Race Forward, and also the publisher of Colorlines.com. Rinku has written two books. Her first book, Stir It Up, Lessons in Community Organizing, was commissioned by the Ms. Foundation for Women and released in the fall of 2003. Her second book, The Accidental American, Immigration and Citizenship in the Age of Globalization, was released in September of 2008, and it won the Nautilus Book Award Silver Medal and also was a finalist for the Forward Magazine 2008 Book of the Year Award in May of 2009. Since leaving Race Forward, Rinku has been working as a consultant with various racial justice organizations and writing her own thoughts on politics and world affairs at her website, rinkusen.com. I'll have my conversation with Rinku about issues of political intersectionality and movement building in the age of Trump after this week's commentary. Well, it has been an interesting week. Lots of news. I want to start off with the Super Bowl. The Philadelphia Eagles have won their first Super Bowl in history by dethroning the New England Patriots in a really spectacular game. Even for people who aren't huge football fans, it's really one of the better Super Bowls that have ever been played. Really one of the best football games that I've ever seen. So the Eagles win. And in the wake of the Super Bowl, there is, of course, revelry, as always happens when a team wins the big game, right? It happens every time, whether it's baseball, basketball, football. What was interesting was, and not necessarily all that surprising because it happens all the time, is that when the partygoers and the revelers in the winning team's hometown go into the streets and they tear shit up, I mean, they were knocking down light posts, flipping over police cars, throwing trash cans, rocks and bottles, burning things. This happens every time that there's a big game. And every time it happens, two things are notable. Number one, that the folks engaged in the violence are almost always overwhelmingly, not almost always, always overwhelmingly white people. And secondly, that the revelry is not considered a riot. Even though if they were black and brown and doing the very same behavior, knocking over police cars, for God's sake, throwing rocks and bottles, setting things on fire, knocking down public property, destroying property, there is no question that they would be viewed as engaged in a riot. Or, of course, if they were any group of people, but especially people of color, protesting some type of injustice, actually trying to make a political statement, then it would be seen as dangerous. It's okay to destroy property, apparently, in the name of good old-fashioned sports fun. It's okay, apparently, to flip police cars. But God forbid you are protesting injustice, and God forbid you be black and brown in the doing of it. This has been going on for a long time. Nothing new here. I started writing about this in the 1990s because I kept noticing every year you would hear these stories, right, mostly on college campuses, of colleges where they would have these riots. Michigan State had like three or four of these over the course of a 7 or 8 year period, where whenever their team would win, usually it'd be in the Final Four, whenever they'd get in late deep into the NCAA tournament, and whether they would win or lose, Michigan State would have a riot. Sometimes they would advertise these riots ahead of time. There was one, I don't remember which year it was. It might have been 03 or it might have been 99. I can't recall because, like I said, they've had several. But they actually were printing up t-shirts ahead of time announcing the riot. Actually, one of the t-shirts had a bottle of Absolut vodka on it, and the writing on the shirt said Absolut riot, you know, Michigan State. It had like the date on it, right? So it was premeditated. These white students, and it was overwhelmingly white students, not because there aren't black and brown students at Michigan State University and these other colleges. There are. In many cases, there are plenty of black and brown folks at many of these schools, and yet they rarely go out into the streets and destroy stuff the way those white kids do, because they know that A, they're going to be viewed as rioters, B, they're probably going to get arrested, or C, they're going to get shot. But these white folks do it with impunity over and over and over, rarely ever get arrested, never get brutalized by the cops. There was a riot at Washington State University in Pullman back in 98 or 99. I think it was late 90s. And the same thing happened. They had students were throwing cans of beer that had been frozen. So they were rock solid, you know, solid as a brick, throwing these beer cans at the heads of police officers. Not one of those kids got shot. There was some student that actually threw a manhole cover, a couple of students that threw a manhole cover at a police officer and hit them. There were several cops had to go to the hospital to be treated for injuries. Not one of the white kids had their head beaten in by the cops or got shot by the cops. And I don't even think there were very many arrests, certainly not any significant prosecutions of those students. And by the way, I'm not saying that they should have been shot. I'm not saying that I wish the cops had beaten them. That's obviously not the proper response. I'm just trying to point out the inconsistency, right? When people of color engage in this kind of behavior, it is labeled a riot and those involved are treated as criminals. When white folks do it in the name of team revelry and solidarity with their football or basketball team, it is seen as just good, clean fun that occasionally gets out of control. So that's one story. Second thing, also related to the Super Bowl. You know, a lot of people watch the Super Bowl for the ads, people who aren't necessarily big football fans, or even if you are, like if you don't have a team, you know, if you don't have a dog in the hunt, so to speak, and neither team is one that really appeals to you, you might be watching for the ads. It's sort of become an annual ritual, right? What's the best ad? What's the worst ad? That kind of thing. Well, this year there were lots of decent ads, as there always are. There's one that is stirring quite a bit of controversy, though, and for good reason. You probably saw it if you watched the game. It was an advertisement by Dodge Ram, the truck folks, right? And it was an ad that was touting the Dodge Ram Nation volunteer program, but it also featured, interspersed between clips of people serving others in some capacity, images of Dodge trucks. So it was both a nod to the volunteer program, but let's also be honest, it was also an ad intended to sell you Dodge Rams. Well, that's fine. The problem, of course, with this advertisement was that the voiceover for the ad was a segment of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous drum major instinct speech, which was given a couple of months before he was assassinated. It is one of his most famous and really one of his most important speeches. I highly recommend that you Google it, look it up, read the whole thing. But they were using Dr. King's voice and his message about the importance of serving others, which is part of the message of drum major instinct. It is not, by the way, the biggest part of the message of that speech. That's why I want you to go listen to it, because the speech is actually about quite a bit more than that. But anyway, they use this statement about the importance of service as a way to sell you trucks, as a marketing thing. And this is some bullshit that I have been noticing, and I'm sure you have too, over the years when it comes time for MLK Day. You know that we're in trouble when you can take a holiday for a man as radical and as important and transformative as Dr. King and use it to sell products. But I remember back in the, again, this would be the early 90s, some of this stuff, you know, it's not new. I was speaking in Seattle for an MLK Day event. And I remember opening up the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which is the main newspaper there in the morning. And there were these ads, it was like a Sunday, I think, that I'd gone in. So it was the day before, you know, the holiday. And on that Sunday, you know, they always have the big ads in the paper on Sunday. And I open up a section and there's all these MLK Day sales. And it was like a furniture store, right? Was using MLK Day as a way to come and get you to buy a recliner, because we all know that that's what Dr. King really loved more than anything, more than justice. He liked a good Barca lounger, I suppose, right? And then there was another, I don't know if it was Sears or JCPenney or I don't know, somebody had an ad. They were, now this was actually sort of funny. It was a white sale, right? Which, given the context of Dr. King and the issue of race, is a little humorous when you think about it, but then it's also not humorous, because what is a white sale? It's a sale on linens, like sheets. In other words, the Klan, you know, could go and get their linens on MLK Day for cheap. They get to do terrorism on the cheap. They get a discount. Oh my God. So I remember looking at those ads and thinking, holy hell, what has happened, right? That we're using this as just another opportunity to market. And then there it is during the Super Bowl, same shit, this Dodge Ram commercial. What is interesting is somebody went, I don't know who did it. I came across it earlier today. Somebody took the visuals of the Dodge ad and stripped out the audio that they used and overlaid another part of Dr. King's Drum Major Instinct speech. It is a part of that speech that Dodge itself did not want to play, because there is part of the Drum Major Instinct speech where Dr. King actually goes in on advertising specifically. It's the most ironic thing that Dodge would pull part of that speech to sell products, when in another part of that speech, he actually criticizes the way that we are marketed to in this country. One of the things he says, I'll quote from it directly, he says, "They have a way of saying things to you that kind of gets you into buying. In order to be a man of distinction, you must drink this whiskey. In order to make your neighbors envious, you must drive this type of car. Before you know it, you're just buying that stuff. That's the way the advertisers do it." And he goes on to say that people end up living their entire lives trying to outdo the Joneses, right? Rather than trying to build up community and work together to solve common problems. But again, not surprising, because that's what we've allowed this country to do to the memory of Dr. King, to sanitize it, to water it down, to strip Dr. King of all radical value whatsoever. Next story, another football-related story. Indianapolis Colts player Edwin Jackson, linebacker, was killed. His car, he was in an Uber, and he and the Uber driver were killed as they pulled along the side of an interstate and were hit by a drunk driver. That drunk driver happens to be a Guatemalan citizen who was in the country, quote unquote, illegally, had been previously deported on two different occasions, but had come back into the United States. Donald Trump, of course, taking the opportunity, as you can expect, to exploit this horrible tragedy, as he did with the death of Kate Steinle in San Francisco at the hands of another undocumented person, right, to push for deportations, to push for the wall, to push for crackdowns on immigration, making the argument that, you know, Edwin Jackson would still be alive if it weren't for quote unquote illegal immigration. And this is a really cynical argument, though, and I hope people can think this through critically. I fear that a lot of folks won't be able to, because at first glance, it seems like a reasonable argument. Edwin Jackson, for instance, would still be alive if this person weren't in the country. At least that's the theory, right? But it's still an absurd argument. Here's the problem with this argument, aside from the fact that it's exploiting fear. The fact is, yes, it's true. If he had not been in the country, then Edwin Jackson would still be alive. But he could have come into the country legally. He could have been documented, and he still could have had a drug and alcohol problem. He still could have been driving that truck or that car that night while under the influence of a substance. So the fact that he was undocumented isn't really the issue. The fact is, he was undocumented, yes, but more importantly, he was driving under the influence. He was inebriated, whether he was a citizen or not, whether he was a lawful resident or not, whether he was in the country with proper paperwork or not, he could have still been behind the wheel of that car and drunk. So what if he had come into the country legally? What if we had an easier process, for instance, for becoming a citizen, so he wouldn't have gone to the trouble of trying to sneak back into the country twice? He could have come legally, but he still would have had the same problem with alcohol. And then what do we then call for? Ending legal immigration? Jackson would still be dead, whether he had been killed by someone who was undocumented or not. And this particular driver could have entered the country legally, could have been here he was not here legally, but he could have been. He could have come in on a visa, for instance, and overstayed the visa. But because he actually crossed the border illegally, it becomes easier for Donald Trump to use in this manner, even though it really isn't the issue. Second point, what if he had been killed not by an undocumented migrant from Guatemala? What if Edwin Jackson had been killed by a white Christian? What if he had been killed by a white supremacist? What if some white terrorist, who we never, of course, use that term for, but what if some white terrorist had killed him or killed some other NFL player because they were upset about NFL ball players, black players, taking a knee in protest of police brutality? Would Trump then say that that was a sign that white right-wingers were the problem and that we needed to crack down on them? Would he back off of his own criticism of NFL players for taking a knee? Of course not. So this is a completely cynical exploitation of the people of this country's fear, some people's fear, of undocumented migrants. If he had been killed by a white Christian, a citizen of this country, a right-winger who was angry, for instance, about NFL players taking a knee, Donald Trump wouldn't be saying anything. What this is just another attempt, as with the death of Kate Steinle in San Francisco, to gin up anger at the undocumented, and particularly undocumented black and brown folks. Because I got to tell you, if Edwin Jackson had been hit and killed that night by an Irish guy who is one of the 50,000 undocumented Irish folks in this country right now. 50,000 undocumented Irish folk living in this country, most of whom came on work or education visas and have overstayed those visas. If that's who had killed Edwin Jackson, I doubt very seriously that Donald Trump would be making political noise about this. I don't think he'd be tweeting about it. I don't think he would be talking about the need to crack down on redheaded, freckled Irish folks who overstay their visas, right? Even though people who overstay visas are 40 to 50% of the undocumented in this country, almost half of the undocumented did not cross any border illegally. They came perfectly legally. They have overstayed visas, but that doesn't play to Trump's base. They want to talk about the wall because that's this physical symbol, this barrier between the awful brown folks to the south and those of us who live in the wonderful United States of America that is open to everyone except those horrible people from those quote-unquote shithole countries. Next story real quick. And this has to do with the economy. The stock market took a dive at the end of last week and then again at the beginning of this week, tumbled the single largest one-day point drop in history. Not percentage drop, but point drop. And a lot of folks on the left are making a big deal out of it because, you know, we like to be able to beat the president up a little on this one because he always takes credit, right? He's been taking credit constantly for the increase in the stock market. The stock market is broken several records over the last several months, over the last year. And every time that happens, Donald Trump wants to take credit. So naturally, when he takes credit for all that stuff that's quote unquote good, it's easy for those of us who are on the other side of things to use this against him when the stock market drops. Same thing happened recently. Donald Trump took credit for African-American unemployment dropping to the lowest rate on record. But then this month, that rate bumped back up again. And so we've been using that to hit him over the head. Here's the problem with that. I understand on the one hand, wanting to point out the hypocrisy, right? The inconsistency of Trump taking credit for every bit of good news, but then when there's bad news, he dodges responsibility or tries to put the responsibility back on Obama or whatever, right? Obviously, pointing out the inconsistency is valuable, but there is a problem with people on the left making too big a deal out of the stock market situation, and here's why. If we're going to say that it's a bad thing for the stock market to go down, then that means we must assume that it's a good thing when the stock market goes up. Not only does that put us in the position of having to applaud him as president when it goes up, which is not a position we want to be in, but more importantly, that's not even very good economics because the stock market often will go up because things are happening to average everyday working people that are not good. One of the things, for instance, that causes a company's stock value to rise is the process of massive layoffs, right? If a company lays off thousands of workers as a way to downsize or what they like to call right-size the company, their stock value normally goes up. Their profitability goes up because investors love it when they lay people off. They see that as correcting a labor problem, right? So you could be laying off thousands of people. You could be moving the plant to Mexico. You could be moving the plant to Sri Lanka, and you will be rewarded in the stock market. So I don't think we on the left want to necessarily tie our beliefs about economics to an improving stock market, which disproportionately benefits the upper middle class and the affluent at the expense of the working class. By the same token, sometimes the stock market will go down for reasons that are actually good for most Americans. Like if wages are starting to go up, and they are, wages have risen this last year at a higher rate than they've been rising, that will sometimes cause investors to freak out a little bit, right? Because investors are afraid, my God, if the workers start getting more money, then the labor market will tighten, and then they will have more power vis-a-vis owners. And by the way, inflation might go up. And so they start to freak out about that. And that's one of the reasons that you see the stock market take a dive. So average everyday working people sometimes are doing well when the stock market takes a dive to an extent. Obviously, you don't want it to collapse altogether, right? But to have a slight dip or even a relatively significant dip, if it is being caused by wage gains, isn't a bad thing. By the same token, to have an increase, if it is being caused by layoffs or if it is being caused by still having a slack labor market or wages not going up for average everyday workers, then that's a problem. So even though I know we want to hit Donald Trump over the head with whatever sort of bad economic news we can, let's not fall into the trap of tying progressive economic thinking to the health of the stock market. We need to be looking at the fundamentals, right? And the reality is the fundamentals of the economy, even though everybody keeps saying they're strong and that they've been getting stronger really ever since 2009 after the Great Recession. Let's not forget that even though wages are starting to go up and even though labor markets are tight and we are at what many economists consider full employment, that's still a lot of underemployment, meaning people who are employed at jobs that are paying far less with far worse benefits than the jobs jobs they had even during the recession. Wages are still down 16 or 17% roughly from where they were in the pre-recession years for millions of Americans in the workforce. And so we don't want to get too happy. We also don't want to make the mistake of thinking that any president, whether it's Barack Obama, whether it's Donald Trump or whomever it is, can really directly influence, particularly in a short period of time, the trajectory of the economy. That's not how it works. You have to look out over many, many years. To whatever extent the economy is doing better right now, it certainly has more to do with the policies of the Obama administration than it does the Trump administration, because the economy has been on the uptick since late 09, early 2010. We will have to wait a few years to see what the effect of the Trump tax cuts are on the economy. He just hasn't done anything in that first year that could really explain any significant aspect of the increase in growth or the increase in wages or the reduction in unemployment. That's going to take a couple of years. The bad news is we have some empirical evidence about what happens when you cut taxes this massively. And what that empirical evidence says, particularly the last time we did that under George W. Bush, is the economy gets worse and we head for recession. That's what we need to be worried about. Now my conversation with activist and author Renku Sen. Well, first off, thank you so much for joining me. I'm really excited to talk to you. There's so many things that we could talk about. You know, as I was getting ready to record this, I saw the news, and I want you to help me sort of walk me through your thoughts on this. So as we're recording this, you know, the Nunes memo, as I guess it's being called, has just been released, and it purports to demonstrate some kind of, you know, widespread FBI bias against Donald Trump, because, you know, as we all know, the FBI has this long history of covert liberalism and hostility to reactionaries like Donald Trump. Putting aside all the obvious questions about the memo and, you know, whether or not it's just a ploy to scuttle the Mueller investigation and all of that, do you ever worry, because I sort of do, and I don't know what to think about it, do you ever worry that a single-minded attention to these matters, not that they are not important, I think they're vitally important, but that the focus on this can in some cases distract from the day-to-day sort of issue-oriented progressive struggles that we need to be focused on right now, whether it's immigration, whether it's healthcare, whether it's police accountability, all of these fights that we have been fighting and need to continue fighting. Sometimes I worry that all of this focus on the corruption, as clear as I think it is, of this administration, can sometimes sap some of the energy and commitment from that. Does that make any sense? And do you ever worry about that?
It does make sense. And I have thought about that. My perspective is actually in a different direction, which is that the continued focus, which I do agree needs to be on the communities that stand to lose the most in this authoritarian and corrupt period, this extraordinarily authoritarian, corrupt period in our federal government, I should say, because it's not like, you know, those things have been never present until now. But I think that the challenge is to connect the theme of corruption and authoritarianism in this administration with those issue struggles. Mm-hmm. So I worry about us running on parallel tracks, about the progressive movement running on parallel tracks that don't meet to create sufficient mass resistance to this administration. And I think the people for whom corruption is their issue, which is not entirely white, there are leaders of color and groups of color working on that. I don't think those folks are going to move off of corruption, and I don't think they should. Somebody needs to pay attention to that. But I think they could do a better job of connecting that to our issues, and we could do a better job of the same. I would like to see these threads come together rather than keep operating in the parallel way that they've been.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point, because it's obvious that the authoritarian tendencies of this administration that we see in the attempt to, let's say, obstruct justice or keep Donald Trump from, you know, the crosshairs of the Mueller investigation, it is the very same tendency that then leads them to do what they are trying to do on immigration. That's also a neo-fascist authoritarian impulse, or what they're doing with, you know, calling for
you know, during the campaign, the whole law and order signaling and calling for, you know, nationwide stop and frisk and all of these things. So I think you make a really good point. Why do you think it's so hard for folks to connect those dots, whether it is in, let's say, first of all, sort of progressive movement space? Maybe there it's just a question of people are in their silos and they're doing what they specialize in, and maybe that's just to be expected. But then also within, let's say, the Democratic Party, because obviously, however non-progressive we know them to be on so many things, right now at the sort of national political level, that's the party that at least ostensibly is the opposition to Donald Trump. Why is it so hard for them to connect the dot? Because it seems like the narrative you're talking about would be a really powerful one that could connect a lot of constituencies with a lot of different issues. What is so hard about that, you think, for people?
I think what's hard about it is that many white progressives, they have a good class lens and a good democracy lens, but their race and gender and queer lenses are weak. And then I think in the identity-based movements, that our democracy lens is a little weak. We feel a lot of conflict, which is justifiable conflict, about whether we can trust this democracy to do anything for us that lasts. And so I think our ambivalence about this democracy and the forms it has taken, many of which have not been good for us, keeps us from digging further into how we want to shape that democracy, which I do think is shapeable. And I think this is still, we're still in the early years of this republic, and it's still in formation. And so, but I think our ambivalence about government institutions, about government itself, prevents us from thinking about how we might govern and how we can get to govern, because we're more accustomed to being in the opposition space. So in part, what I've been thinking a lot about in social movements is a reboot that connects social movements more strategically to electoral politics and electoral organizing, where there's also a lot of pretty radical progressive stuff happening, I think. And I don't come out of electoral organizing. I come out of community organizing, direct action. And I didn't do anything electoral, I would say, for the first 25 years of my career. And I think that is... that I think of that as a mistake now. And I think that people like Marisa Franco, who is one of the founders of Mi Gente, the National Latinx Network, you know, Marisa has a vision and was able to work with others in Arizona to carry it out during the 2016 election. She has a vision of how to put these two powerful threads of organizing together. And so I would follow her. Yeah. Like, there are leaders like her, Nalini Stamp at the Working Families Party. There are young women of color in particular leading on making that connection between elections and social movements, and we should lift them up and their strategies and do more like they do.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I do think, and it's been frustrating for me for you know, the 30 years approximately that I've been involved in various left movements and politics, this sort of either or divide that we've all sort of played into to some extent between electoral politics and community organizing. And it's sort of like these two teams that look at each other as, you know, oh, you're a phony, or, oh, you know, you're just troublemaking for the sake of troublemaking. When in fact, you know, community organizing and the sensibilities of community organizers could actually be very valuable to electoral campaigners. And the sort of, I don't know, the strategic wisdom that people who work on electoral campaigns gain from that could also be really valuable for community organizers. And yet we've always sort of had that divide, you know, whether it's people who, I mean, you know, the famously in the 90s, I remember seeing all the time that, you know, people would drive around ostensibly progressives with bumper stickers that said, you know, if voting changed anything, it would be illegal. And they thought that was some radical statement, I suppose. But, you know, to me, it was always very cynical, because even though I absolutely get the limitations of electoral politics, and I get the limitations, God knows, of the Democratic Party in its current iteration, first of all, if voting didn't matter at all, then people wouldn't be trying to stop people from doing it, right? I mean, there wouldn't be this concerted effort to disenfranchise millions of people, mostly of color and low income and working class people, if somebody didn't think it mattered, right? Like if it was all just rigged and there was no point in voting, then they would just let everybody vote and make sure it was easy to vote. But somebody knows it does matter. So where does this cynicism, you think, come from within the left? And what are a couple of ways, just real practical ways that people can think about it so that they don't fall into the trap of thinking I can either be out in the streets and doing community work or I can be working on campaigns?
Well, I think the first thing to acknowledge here is you've acknowledged that electoral politics and voting have their limitations, as does the Democratic Party. I think it's important to acknowledge that direct action membership-based organizing also has its limitations. Yeah. And these two strategies for creating new society are limited by their forms. You know, they're in certain containers and there are natural limitations. It's not because electoral organizers are so blind that they can't see that if you lose an election, then a lot of resources have gone into that could have been doing other things. Right. And I think, you know, among community organizers, we could also have a bit more humility and recognize that our container lives outside of institutions, you know, but that inside of institutions, there is also work to be done, and that's important work. So it's not a personal moral failing of the leaders in those strategies that the strategies have limitations. Right. They have limitations because there are only certain things you can accomplish with that strategy, no matter how great the strategy is. A couple of the practical things I think to do are, I do think running for office and running locally is a good thing to do if you have any interest. Even if you lose, if you're a progressive candidate of color and you lose, you will learn a lot, and so will your colleagues and friends and community and members. If you come out of a community organization, so will they. If you're running electoral campaigns, I think reaching out to the community organizing world and to the members and leaders in that world is a good idea while you're running. So the local races and, you know, using local races to create a two-way connection between the strategies and the people running those strategies seems like an important long-term investment, even if we lose the local races in the short term.
Sure, sure. Well, I think all that speaks to this need that we have, those of us who are pushing for any form of social justice, economic justice, political justice in this culture, to sort of think capaciously about the need for having all hands on deck, so to speak, within this work. And we really don't have the luxury of sort of parceling out and saying, well, this is what the work looks like, or that's what the work looks like. It's all the work. And that actually brings me to something I certainly wanted to talk to you about. A few weeks ago, when the Golden Globe Awards were held, there was a lot of, I found it to be pretty unproductive, but I understood where it came from: consternation and critique. So we have, obviously, in the midst of the Me Too and Time's Up awareness, you know, movements around issues of sexual predation, male sexual predation and sexual assault of women and abuse of women, harassment, all of the things we're hearing coming out of Hollywood, and that we're also hearing coming out of just about every walk of life in America, every industry, every geographic space. There were a group of folks, admittedly, you know, Hollywood stars at the Golden Globes, who, you know, took the opportunity to take a stand in solidarity with women, not only in Hollywood, but around the world, facing that. And there was a lot of, I won't say, not necessarily a lot, but there was certainly some pushback from various corners of the left, broadly speaking, that seemed very skeptical, even cynical, about wealthy, I guess, celebrities, you know, making this stand, as if somehow it was inauthentic, or if somehow it was only focused on Hollywood and it was lacking, you know, this broader left and progressive analysis. And although I certainly understand, you know, a healthy dose of skepticism sometimes, it does strike me that we do have this weird tendency sometimes on the left to have this puritanism that says, you know, if you're not really of us and you don't come out of us as the left, then we can't really trust that you're really about the work. And you wrote a really, I thought, powerful piece trying to put this whole thing in perspective in terms of this pushback. If you could talk a little bit about your thoughts on that and how you think maybe those of us on the left can avoid falling into that cynicism where we just sort of snipe each other, even when someone's trying to take a stand and do the right thing, but it's not enough. You know, how do we deal with that?
Yeah, my motto on this question is better now than never. Yeah. I think that a lot of us on the left get triggered by celebrity action because we have been alone for so long and having felt abandoned by the larger society and the mainstream society for such a long time. I think that's where some of the cynicism comes from. You know, there's a little bit of a sense of betrayal there, like we've been doing this forever and nobody could be bothered until it was their problem too. So I do sympathize and I have felt that myself. I think what was interesting about the Time's Up action is that it wasn't just a group of celebrities going to the Golden Globes who participated. Pretty much every woman actor who went to the Golden Globes participated by wearing black and by gearing her interview talking points toward Time's Up. All of the press, I watched hours of, you know, red carpet interviews that night before the show started, like 3 hours of it between various channels. And my unscientific count is that 75% of those interviews mentioned only Time's Up. You know, there was no discussion of designers and who you're wearing.
Right.
There was even fairly little discussion of what do you hope will happen tonight and the awards. It was all Time's Up. And, you know, the effect of having 5 or 6 hours worth of programming on national television in a popular venue that isn't overtly political, I just don't think we can even measure the importance of that on the public's imagination. And, you know, I'm so grateful to Tarana Burke and Monica Ramirez for helping. I think the actors and the women in Hollywood had a really good idea with Time's Up. And Tarana and Monica and other organizer friends who went helped them make it better, make their plan better and bigger. And I think that collaboration really worked. So I also understand, you know, I just had a conversation the other day with one of my elder mentors. And he said, oh, I like that piece. I agreed with you on a lot of it. He said, you know, in his usual grouchy way, yeah, the celebrity stuff kind of gets on my nerves. And, you know, I get that. But I think we make a mistake to assume that celebrity action doesn't have real thought and strategy behind it. Right. We don't even always know what the thought and strategy is behind movement organizations' actions, you know, our own peers' actions. So judging before we have really investigated, I think, is not good. What I tried to do in that piece, which is lay out what I knew and how the action struck me from a strategy standpoint. And my big urge for us, though, out of that piece, and at the end of it, I say something about how a lot of people said that, you know, celebrities are too shallow to really give, to really dig into this issue or any issue. And all they want to do is, you know, put on a fancy dress if it has to be a particular color. So, you know, that's fine. But I think the lesson there is celebrities, they're just like us. You know, yeah. Most human beings are very busy and pretty shallow, and don't spend a lot of time thinking deeply even about social trends that they care about. And if we can lower the bar for participation so that people can do something that is shallow, we understand it has limited meaning and effect, but everybody's got to do the first thing in order to do the next thing. And as movement leaders, it's on us to design that first thing in ways that really as many, many, many people as possible can participate in it.
Right. Well, and the thing is, precisely because celebrities maybe are not in a position in terms of their knowledge base or their background to carry the ball with, you know, and run this movement, which we don't want them to do, precisely, you know, that then creates space for those who are movement activists. So if celebrities step forward, they raise awareness, then they can step back precisely because they're not running the show, precisely because they're not the movement activists. And then that means those who do that every single day will now have an audience that they literally could not have paid for. So I think it is, you know, incumbent upon us to really think about how our justifiable skepticism and maybe even cynicism about celebrity and about bigness and about success and all this other stuff in this very shallow way that America defines success sometimes gets in our way, right? Because we it's almost as if a message isn't radical and meaningful unless it's obscure. Right. If it's obscure, then it's real. And once it's big and once somebody is out there getting, you know, and has any kind of traction at all. I mean, I remember that used to be the thing people said about Noam Chomsky was the reason Noam Chomsky was legit about his critiques of U.S. foreign policy was precisely because nobody would interview him. Right. It wasn't about it wasn't about whether his arguments were strong. It was just about the fact that he was this niche, you know, linguist and theorist that you had to be a lefty to know about. That's just like a really weird standard, right? I think we have to sort of take these small victories. And one of the things at Golden Globes that I found interesting, and I think it'd be hard to miss it, was the way in which several of those interviews that you mentioned, and even, you know, the speech by Oprah Winfrey, talked about in direct and indirect ways issues of intersectionality, connecting issues of race and class and gender and sexuality in ways that we do not hear done very often in dominant celebrity culture or even mainstream corporate media, which I think is obviously a pretty important thing, which then makes me want to ask you, because I know you've written about this and you've done a lot of thinking around this issue of intersectionality. Here is this term that Kimberly Crenshaw essentially initiates this terminology back in the late 80s and early 90s to talk about the need for connecting issues, particularly of race and gender, within anti-discrimination law and some of the fallacies of existing anti-discrimination law. Nowadays, that term gets used a lot. It's used by activists. It's used by organizers. We hear it often. And on the one hand, I think that's fantastic, as with the Golden Globes discussion of it. But what are some of the dangers in your mind about a term like that when it's so easily thrown around, sometimes without a really clear and consistent understanding of its meaning? What does it mean to you? And what are your concerns about the looseness, perhaps, with which it's thrown around, at least in some circles?
Well, what intersectionality means to me is that it's the practice of looking at a particular problem or situation through a variety of lenses. The lenses, you might think of them like camera filters or Snapchat filters or Instagram filters. You put the filter on and it can obscure certain things in the picture but highlight other things. You put another filter on, it highlights additional things. So race, class, gender, sexuality, to me, they're like filters, systemic filters. And those systems create hierarchies out of who we are, out of our actual identities. It is the practice of looking through different people's eyes and through different people's experiences at the same problems, at a particular set of problems. And when you apply that lens to a problem, sometimes the problem gets bigger. You realize something like, oh, when we're working on domestic violence, the problem isn't just getting women out of the house safe. The problem is also creating services that monolingual Spanish speakers or monolingual non-English speakers can access. So when we design a system of solutions around domestic violence, we have to not just make sure we provide women a way to get out of the house, but also a way for all women to access services. So I think, you know, one of the reasons we resist applying those additional lenses is that they inevitably make our problem bigger and more challenging. And so there's a little bit of, I don't want that pain, so I'm gonna like block it from reaching me. But then that means that we end up with limited and criticizable solutions, solutions that people are definitely going to criticize because they don't cover everybody. So I think, you know, thinking of intersectionality as an analysis, as a matter of looking at a problem through different lenses, might help us do less identity policing and go beyond making demands around representation.
that's sort of the irony of it, because I think that some people who critique, because just as intersectionality has become sort of a buzzword, the critique of it has also become very, you know, sort of big within the right and those who don't like the analysis of intersectionality. And they'll talk about it as if it is the ultimate capitulation to, you know, quote unquote, identity politics in the worst sense of that term. When really what you're saying, and I think this is an important distinction, it actually is a bridge between identities that form identity politics in a way that creates a broader whole and actually to some extent avoids the pitfalls of our silo politics, right?
Yeah, because it allows you to be truly inclusive. At the end of the piece I wrote on how to do intersectionality, that's what I called it. At the end of it, I wrote about how we could be more consistent in that analysis. And I took on the ways that, at least in racial justice movements and organizations, we deal with white poverty, for example. And, you know, one of the things I say is that while white privilege is, of course, applies to poor white people as well as rich white people, the poverty of poor white people must mitigate the effects of white privilege. It must. How could it not? But we tend to say the opposite, which is, you know, white privilege, it leads in the experience of a poor white person. And then that's how we approach poor white people. So I think that's a mistake. And yeah. I think that the right deliberately misunderstands identity politics, and therefore it deliberately misunderstands intersectionality. And in the sort of struggles around academia and scholarship and universities, intersectionality is in the right's crosshairs. They are coming after that concept hard. And I think that they're making specious arguments, and we don't need to feed their arguments by practicing it wrong, you know, right. By doing it wrong. If we do it right, then actually I think we can find some real creative paths around the right-wing dog whistles to white people who should be with us.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really crucial point. And it's one that I know for myself, I've learned over the years, and it was hard to learn, because as someone who started out and, you know, for most of my career and my activist life, obviously focusing mostly on issues of race and talking a lot about issues of white supremacy and white privilege, there was a time many years ago when I was so insistent that whenever you were talking about white privilege, if a white person wanted to, you know, talk about their class marginality or their gender marginality or their sexual marginality, I viewed that in the back of my head, and sometimes in the front of my head even, as a deflection, right? And I think most of us who were trained to talk about those issues of race, that was sort of what we were trained to think. Like, that's, you're just trying to get out of it, rather than saying, no, wait a minute, like, those identity, yeah, you may be deflecting, that may be what you're doing, but that doesn't mean that your pain around poverty, or that your pain around misogyny, or that your pain around straight supremacy or whatever isn't real. And so what would it really cost me to say, wait a minute, you know what, I'm going to let you have that victory. We're going to talk about that too. And we're going to talk about how that marginality is actually connected in a weird way to your privilege and interacts with it, and how that marginality complicates your privilege just as the privilege complicates your marginality. And I think we weren't trained to do that, because again, maybe it's part of the siloing on the left, that it's like, no, we got to focus on this, and this is the issue, rather than sort of stepping back and thinking about how we really build coalitions.
I think that there is deflection. I had that debate a lot in the 90s over gender, class, and other things. So that's not an illegitimate reaction from us. The principle in pretty much all communications is that if you want to persuade somebody in your direction, you have to connect with them. So we can't let our search for defense against deflection wipe out our ability to connect before we try to pivot with and educate that person. But I think just putting the question out is right. Like, I hear you, you know, raising class and your class history, and I'm intrigued by that. And sometimes I've heard people use that to deflect from the race discussion. are we connecting or deflecting here? And right. if we're connecting, can we go in this direction? I think we can talk to each other like that as long as our tone is kind and we are prepared to really listen to the answer.
It sort of speaks to this issue of how do we bring a certain strategic thinking to our ideological commitments? Because sometimes I feel like we're not always thinking strategically. One of the issues that I worry about with that has to do with the issue of immigration. And I talked a few months ago with Tia Oso about this, and I've discussed it with others. I'd like to get your thoughts on it. It seems to me right now on the immigration debate, particularly around DACA, there is a tendency among some within, I'm not going to say the left, I'm going to say the liberal left, and certainly within the Democratic Party, to sort of frame the defense of the Dreamers with this, you know, this narrative of, oh, you know, they've done nothing wrong, they're not to blame, they're innocent. And I worry that this strategically, I'm sure to some people makes sense because you're trying to ensure that these folks, you know, will be able to stay in the country and not be deported. But I worry about how it sets up this dichotomy, right, between the innocent children and then presumably, I guess, their terrible parents who sought a better life for them, right? I worry that it has this potential to backfire on the larger struggle for immigrant and refugee justice and the larger struggle for human rights. What are your thoughts about that? And how can we maybe avoid, again, falling into that trap of setting up the good immigrants and the bad immigrants. You know what I mean?
This is a really hard one. And I'll tell you why I think it's hard. One problem is this desire that human beings have to split us into deserving and undeserving and innocent and guilty, and the very fast judgments that come from having racist synapses going off in our brains. So that idea that we can presume innocence or guilt without racist stereotypes influencing us is really a mistake. So whenever we use those frames, we have to acknowledge that race and poverty and gender, to a degree, race and class and gender, all influence our judgments about who is innocent and who is guilty. Having said that, I think that I'm going to say something that I really am not too clear about myself yet, but that I've been mulling over. And it is that when we tell only hard stories about how victimized we have been by the system, I worry that the repetition of those stories actually continues to pathologize communities of color. And so I want some balance in the mainstream media, in our own communications, progressive communications. I want some balance that restores agency to people of color. And in the immigration debate, that's what I think is part of this DACA framing. It's like the Dreamers themselves, they had no agency because they were kids. And we're not talking about their parents as agents, we're talking about their parents as criminals. And I think that if we could bring some agency to the debate, that would be really great. And I think a lot of the DACA recipients have already been doing that. You know, United We Dream and Undocumedia often produce memes and quotes and stories that say, we're so proud of our parents, we would never abandon our parents, all gratitude to our parents. But that has not become the mainstream discussion around DACA yet. It would be good if it could.
I think that's a great point. And it also brings up this larger issue about the stories that we tell, because one of the tendencies that I know I've been trying to figure out, you know, how in my own work to move through it. I think those of us on the left oftentimes have a tendency to be really, really strong on, you know, we have our facts and we've got our data and we know all this analysis and we've got a lot of good theory. And I think sometimes we place an unnatural and frankly, sort of unhealthy faith in the power of pure reason to win political debates, right? Because we know from the brain science research that it really isn't facts and data and statistics and analysis that really moves people from point A to point B. It's really storytelling. It's really narrative. And I feel like sometimes, you know, those of us on the left, it's like, you know, we're the debate team and the right is the pep club right? And or the cheerleaders, and we know which one does more inspiring. Like, they know marketing and we know sociology, and there's a place for the sociology, but I feel like we got to do better storytelling. What are some, first of all, I'd like to get your thoughts on that, you know, the importance of storytelling more so than just having a lot of great facts and numbers, but also, what are some examples that you see out there throughout the country of folks doing a good job of getting some of the narrative that we need that really touches people and really moves people and that we know is so important to persuasion?
That is a great question. So stories are critical to any kind of social change program because our affinity for stories and symbols is what makes us human. Stories are so core to who we are as human beings. One of the things that was hardest for me to integrate into my head is that entire worldviews are stories. So the right has a worldview and a definition and a story about America. And I think of that story as illegitimate. Many parts of that story is illegitimate. But I'm just telling a competing story of America. America itself is a story. Like, how everybody around the world looks at that symbol is the story they're holding in their head. So the idea that my story is actually no more legitimate than the right story is difficult for me to integrate into my thinking. But once I did, it made me take a harder look at the stories I was telling and at the things I was telling stories about. And, you know, what the neuroscience says is that when a person has a worldview or a dominant frame in their head and you give them facts, their brain is going to reject the facts, sometimes without them even being conscious that they're rejecting the facts. The brain kind of wants to protect itself and wants to be efficient. Our brains don't actually like to work hard. It loves rapid associations and wants efficiency. So it chooses the most efficient thing to do with contradictory information to the way we've lived our lives and the frames we've long held. And so facts and data, they don't tap into the story parts of our brain sufficiently enough to make our brains want to do that hard work, desire to do that hard work. But our brains love stories. They love a plot. They love characters. They love to be transported to other settings. So that's the reason to use stories when facts and data fail, especially when they fail. When I do my work and I ask advocates and organizers to tell me a story, very often what they tell me is a description. My kid goes to this terrible school. It has no toilet paper. The books are from 1985. And they'll give me a description of the school. But what I want to know that makes it a story is, what's a typical day in your kid's life like? What happens to your kid in the course of going to school? And most importantly, if you want me to take some action, what is that action? And how's your story going to lead me to the emotion I need to feel to be willing to take that action and be clear with me about what the action is? So storytelling just will expand our toolkit immeasurably. And there's a lot of great experimentation happening on that front in our movement. In the next period, we need to consolidate the lessons and take that storytelling to scale.
Well, one more thing I wanted to talk with you about before we're done on the show today. I remember many years ago, we were on a panel together at Race Forward in Baltimore, and you said something that really stuck with me all these many years later. You were trying to draw a distinction between the use of the concept of racism and using that terminology and that framing versus the use of the concept of racial inequity. Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it's something that those of us who do this work, we obviously talk about it, but I just liked the way that you framed it. And even though I had made similar arguments, I just thought you made the argument in a very clear, crystallized way about why it is valuable to speak of racial inequity more so than racism per se. Could you talk a little bit about that? First off, am I remembering correctly? And then more importantly, what is the argument there and why is it important?
I think what I had said is that most Americans define racism as individual, intentional, and overt. So if there isn't a noose hanging or a slur that everybody recognizes as a slur being slung around, then many Americans just cannot see the racism present, which is probably systemic. They can't see the systemic racism present. And because Americans think that individual, intentional, and overt defines racism, when something happens that is bad, they always go looking for the racist. So our big question in addressing racial problems has become, who's the racist? And when you ask that question, you might find an actual intentional overt racist, but much more likely you're going to find a bunch of people who think they have no prejudices, who believe they're colorblind, who sincerely try to do the right thing by everybody, and who cannot see the racial harm caused by their actions or by the system that they are in. So the distinction I want to make is between racist intention and bad racial impact, which you can have. You can have bad racial impact without actually having racist intention. So rather than asking who's the racist, I want us to be asking the question, what is causing racial inequity? That is, what is causing particular impact? And when we ask that question, we may still find a racist. In addition to that racist, or instead of that racist, we will also find lots of practices and policies and rules in our system, whether that system is a family, a school, a workplace, a hospital, whatever, that is causing racial harm. And if we remove the intention, the search for evil intention, in my experience, we can get a lot more people past their initial defensiveness that you're about to call me racist, which is going to throw off every image I've ever had of myself. And it enables them to pivot to, oh, we might be causing racial harm. Let's see if we are. And if we are, let's change something so that we cannot. That's the idea.
And that'll do it for another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. If you're interested in reaching out to my guest today or reading more of her work, you can do that at rinkusen.com. That's RINKUSEN.com. She can also be reached on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media platforms under her name. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show, and look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.